Welcome to Banyan Books, Branches of Wisdom, celebrating the joy of bright ideas and heartful lifelong learning. Branches of Wisdom is a series of intimate conversations with the world's most influential authors and visionaries. We explore spirituality and the human mind, ecology and culture. Most episodes are recorded with a live audience. You can join our live events and submit questions to your favorite guests. Check out our upcoming schedule at banyan.com. Since 1970, Banyan Books has been a rich oasis at the crossroads of wisdom and philosophy, offering resources for humanity's evolving paths. We're a locally owned, independent bookstore in the heart of Vancouver's Kitsilano neighborhood. Visit us in person or shop online at banyan.com. Please subscribe, follow, like, and leave your reviews for the podcast. And now, enjoy. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Branches of Wisdom, the Banyan Books podcast. I'm your host, Ross McKeachy, and very excited about our guest today, Angela Sterrett. Before we get to her formal introduction, Banyan Books acknowledges that although we have people joining us from all over the world for these live stream events, our physical location is on the traditional and unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples, including the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh nations. Our guest today, Angela Sterrett, is an award-winning journalist, writer, and artist. Sterrett has worked as a journalist for close to 20 years and has been with the CBC since 2003 as a host and television, radio, and digital reporter. She's a proud member of the Gikxan Nation and lives on Squamish, Musqueam, and Tsleil-Waututh territories in Vancouver, Canada. Sterrett is the host of the CBC original podcast, Land Back, which won a Radio Television Digital News Association Award for Best Podcast in 2023. In 2021, Sterrett won an Academy Award, the Canadian Screen Award, for Best Reporter of the Year in Canada for her coverage of an Indigenous man and his then 12-year-old granddaughter who were arrested while trying to open a bank account at BMO. Sterrett also won a National Radio Television Digital News Association Award for the same reporting. In 2020, she was named in Vancouver Magazine's Power 50 list of the city's top 50 most influential people. That same year, she was nominated for Best Local Reporter by the Canadian Screen Awards for her reporting on Indigenous babies apprehended by the Ministry of Children and Family Development. In 2019, her documentary on the complexity of Indigenous support for and challenges against the Trans Mountain Pipeline Expansion Project won an RTDNA Award for Best Long Feature. In 2007, she accepted the Investigative Award of the Year from Canadian Journalists for Free Expression for coverage of missing and murdered Indigenous women. And she was awarded a prestigious William Southam Journalism Fellowship at Massey College in Toronto and was the first known First Nations person in Canada ever to receive the award in the school's 60-year history. As a motivational speaker, Sterrett talks about breaking stereotypes and creating change and relationships in Indigenous and non-Indigenous communities. And in 2020, she gave a great TED Talk about smashing stereotypes of Indigenous people. This evening, Angela Sterrett is with Banyan Books in conversation about her new book, Unbroken, My Fight for Survival, Hope, and Justice for Indigenous Women and Girls. Unbroken is part memoir and part investigation into the murders and disappearances of Indigenous women and girls, and became a national instant bestseller when it came out in May of 2023. If you'd like to learn more about today's honored guest and her work, you can visit her website at www.angelasterrett.com. Banyan community, please join me in a very warm welcome for Angela Sterrett.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for having me. It's an honor to be here.
So great to have you, Angela. Thanks for being here. I'm wondering if you can just start by telling us where you're from and a bit about the history of your people.
Yeah, that's a great starting point. So I am on my mother's side. My late mother, Delphine Beaulieu, was from Belle Isle, Newfoundland. So on my mom's side, that's my white roots is something that I'm kind of reconnecting with. So I know that she has Irish and English roots, English from the Isles of Jersey. And I think it's really important for us as white people to really start to build those connections. We talk about Indigenous people having connections from their culture being lost for 150 years. What about us on our white sides having thousands of years of disconnection, right? And what does that mean? And what does that have to do with who we are in this country with these Indigenous people? So then on my Indigenous side, I'm Gixan, and my people are actually matrilineal. So in order to be legally recognized by my house group, you actually need to be adopted by a high-ranking member of your house group, which I was this June 21st. And it's kind of a funny story, but as I've told you now, but I also tried to quit CBC 7 months ago. I've now officially quit. So this is a funnier story now. At the time, I was like, oh, it's... So I was taking language courses with my elder and my cousin, our language teacher, and everyone was introducing themselves like, this is my name, this is my house group, this is my clan. And I don't have that because our culture is matrilineal. And so she said, well, we'll give you an honorary Gixan name. And so as I was going to this meeting with my boss, I checked my email and my name was Lualgia Dzumk Beast, which means woman who works in television and radio. Okay, that's going to be funny. It's even funnier now, but it's a real blessing because my grandfather was groomed as a child to be the hereditary chief of Wigak, the House of the Big Wings, and that is the house group that I now legally am recognized under, and I'm Wolf Clan Solakibu from the community of Gitnamax and Gixan. So both sides are really important to me. I'm a very proud Gixan woman, and I'm really honored that I now have this name and, you know, legally belong to my community.
That's beautiful. That's really beautiful. And I understand that your spiritual practice is very important in your life. How do the cultural practices of your Gixan heritage play into that?
Yeah, that's a really great question. You know, we were just talking, I guess, backstage. Before, and I was telling you about reclaiming some of these spiritual practices that I think have kind of been, you know, adapted or adopted or, you know, sometimes misappropriated by non-Indigenous people. And so last year I had a bit of a traumatic event happen, and it really pushed me kind of over the edge. And I think I've heard people like Joe Dispenza, I think his name is, just say like, some people will never get to the next level of change unless they face a crisis in their life, which I did. And I was just forced to begin to really understand what a calm nervous system means. You know, I imagine as a news reporter, you could imagine what that's like, trying to have a calm nervous system in the face of like horrific news, you know, especially me as an Indigenous woman telling these horrific stories daily. So at the time I was doing like 2-hour meditations a day. And really kind of trying to understand that through a lens of ancestors. So, you know, people might see it as, you know, calling on spirit guides or connecting with Mother Earth or, you know, putting your power in the hands of the universe. And so for me, all of that stuff was super easy to understand and be relational in those healing modalities in terms of my own culture. In that, you know, for thousands, tens of thousands of years, we've been praying to our ancestors. We've been giving gratitude to our ancestors. You know, many of our cultures see our ancestors in, you know, the trees, in an oak tree, an oak leaf falling into the water, in the rivers and the power of the mountains, for example. And so, you know, I really started thinking about how to connect in that way, in this sort of indigenizing of these kind of new age modalities. And it's so important to me because, as you'll read in the book, most of my family has now passed away. So my mom, my dad, all my grandparents, actually during the pandemic, almost all my aunties on my dad's side passed on. So connecting to ancestors for me is like everything. It's like how I connect with my family. And I think for people who don't have closeness to their family in terms of, you know, deaths or even just presence, I think having that ancestral connection can be so empowering. And it's literally changed my life. That's why I quit CBC, right? It's like I can't, you know, have a calm nervous system and do bad news every day. It's just, it's not possible. So
right. Tell us more about that, please. The CBC, that's big news.
Yeah. So tomorrow's my last day. I'm so happy. I don't know if you can see the smile on my face. it's so liberating, so freeing. You know, chapter 10 in Unbroken talks all about my experience with CBC. CBC has come a long way. The media, I call it the media because it's an institution. It's a colonial institution that is a product of colonization. And so there's been massive changes being made, right? In terms of even the stories that you'll see on our websites now, there's tons of Indigenous stories and from, you know, maybe not a like neo-colonial lens, but from an Indigenous lens, or maybe, you know, it is a white settler telling the story, but they're really talking to the family members and getting that perspective rather than a white anthropologist or the white CMP officer's perspective. They're going to like Indigenous family members. Specifically, I'm talking about missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. And so there's been so many incredible efforts being made. You know, there's a lot of people in my newsroom in particular who are like, let's be trauma-informed. A couple of years ago, people were like, I don't even know what that is, and it's too much for me, and our audience doesn't care. And now these executives are taking this on and going, let's get this story right. But I think just being the news, it being the news, I think the pretty brutal racism that I've experienced there as an Indigenous person trying to tell Indigenous stories solidly for the past 10 years and just facing a lot of pushback, even as of 2 days ago, I just couldn't do it anymore. And, you know, somebody asked me the other day, what makes you feel not jaded or have hope? And being around my own people or like-minded people who are just calming, right? And not kind of affronting or mocking or you know, concerned about your perspectives, but just welcoming and loving and want to share and want to connect. As humans, that's all we want. We want to connect. And all we have in this world is, you know, the lessons we leave behind and the love that we give. The lessons we leave with are the lessons we learn and the love we leave behind. And I want to be on a different journey. And I feel like it started today, right now, because tomorrow's my last day. Yeah.
Wow. That I'm so happy to hear that. And I mean, it, in a way, it seems fitting that you're doing an interview with Banyan Books on a day like that, where you're trying to change gears in that direction.
Yeah, big time.
You know, I just want to tell people, Angela, that this book is really, I mean, it's heartbreaking and hard in many ways, but it's beautifully written. And it's so skillfully weaves your story in with the stories of many other women and so much deep research that you've done to tell this larger story of these issues of murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls in Canada. So I want people to know how good this book is and how important it is and to read it. One of the things I want to also just tell our audience before we go further, I'm just remembering, Angela's going to take some of your questions the last 15 minutes. So please go ahead and start typing those into the comments field or the chat field on YouTube, and we'll get to as many of those as we can. The beautiful cover art of the book, Angela, you're also a visual artist. I wonder if Jacob, if you can bring up the image, the other one that shows that whole image. Yeah, there it is. Angela, this piece is titled Honor the Dead, Fight for the Living. Honor the Living, Fight for the Dead. Can you tell us about the symbolism here?
Yeah, so there's a lot of symbolism in this painting, actually. This is the only painting I've ever done about missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. So there's kind of two sets of meaning. So the first one is just the way that it looks. So the first, these are all models that are Dene from Yellowknife when I was stationed in Yellowknife. And so the first is a young woman holding a feather, and that means those who lead us. The second woman, Kira, is holding a wooden spoon. And it was, for me, it was thinking about all those women when I grew up on the street who were in the kitchen, you know, in the soup kitchens, you know, making those soups or those spaghettis and feeding us. So the second person, Kira, is those who feed us. And then the third one is actually a friend I reported with. It's a man named Lawrence Nialy, who I transformed into a woman. He was very happy about that. Mm-hmm. And it's an elder, and it's holding up, she's holding up a flower, those who heal us. And really thinking about the family members and those who use their voice and those who continue to fight for the rights and for justice for missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. And then honor the dead, fight for the living, fight for the living, honor the dead. You know, one of the things that when I was writing the book that just constantly struck me is we do a lot of honoring of people when they die, right? I even thought about this with Sinead O'Connor, and just so much love and so much praise. And she did something that everyone's talking about now. She ripped up a picture of the Pope. And where were those people in her lives? And I know we're talking about Indigenous women, but that might be something that just kind of struck me as well. But when I was writing my book, there was a young woman named Tina Fontaine, and it's just, she was so, she was neglected by so many different systems, but people saw her, right? People saw her in high school. They saw her on the street. They saw her in foster homes. They saw her in hotels. They were seeing her. And we see street people. We see people struggling. And she was honored so much, Tina Fontaine, after she died. But where were the murals and the praise and the love when she was alive? So I think it's amazing that we honor those who are no longer with us, but equally important to honor those, you know, who might not fit in, who might not be doing things that are appreciated by everyone, but that are taking a big step forward for human evolution and change, or even just recognition that someone's not doing the best. And so that's what this painting is about.
What would you like to see just the average Canadian do if they see someone who might be struggling on the street? What would you, I think so many people just don't have the literacy or the knowing in terms of how to approach a situation like that, or how they might be able to offer even a kind word or lend a hand in some way.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's hard, right? I think there's a lot of fear around it. And I think there's a fear around our discomfort with feeling sympathy for those who are struggling. And I've, you know, heard my friends tell people on the street, go get a job. And I'm like, I panhandled for like years. That is the hardest job you will ever do in your life. And it actually was an amazing segue to journalism, because you're asking people for spare change. And then when you have a mic, you're asking people to give their comment, you're facing the exact same rejection over and over again. And sometimes with the same disdain. But I think seeing people as human, and, you know, I remember Dr. Goldman from CBC was like, well, I wouldn't say see them as human, they are human. And it's like, yeah, but people don't see people that way. They see poor people or Indigenous people as animals, because that's what we've been taught. And sometimes just someone sitting down and saying, hey, how are you? Or here's some food, or here's some money. And I think there's a lot of like, oh, well, what if they buy it on drugs? Spend it on drugs or spend it on alcohol. And, you know, a lot of times in the winter, I spent, 10 hours or whatever in a freezing cold and abandoned building. And those couple of beers would warm me up, just like the guy who comes home after work and has a couple of beers or pours themselves a cognac. And I think there's just a lot of a stigma and like, dehumanizing, like, oh, they're just going to do this or they're just going to do that, when we're going to go home and do the exact same thing but this person is actually struggling. And I think there's a lot, we go through a lot of like mental justifying of why we don't even just recognize, look someone in the eye, say, hi, how are you? I'm sorry, I don't carry change. I just have a bank card, but I see you. How are you? That's it. You know, and I think that that goes miles, a smile, looking someone in the eye. You know, it sounds small, but I don't think very many people do that.
Yeah. This reminded me of a quote that I wrote down from chapter 4, where you were writing about when you were attending university in Prince George, and you say, I'm quoting now, I don't think many non-Indigenous people understood then, or understand even now, the coping mechanisms that some Indigenous people developed to survive the intergenerational trauma of residential schools, dislocation, systemic sexual abuse, cultural genocides, and starvation. Even I, like many of my young Indigenous friends, was just learning about the severity of colonial violence through university classes from many Indigenous professors with lived experience. Can you try and give us a more of a picture of what you were learning at that time and have continued to learn about the impacts of colonialism?
Yeah, that's like it's a huge question.
Yeah.
You know, I think one of the things that I often talk to about people is I feel like we're at this amazing place in this juncture of, you know, being Canadian, and that a lot of people are willing and wanting and are learning about what happened to children in residential school. You know, they were tortured. They were brutally sexually abused. They were this forced assimilation into a culture that wasn't theirs, is by definition by the United Nations genocide. But I don't think people have yet really dipped into the entire colonial empire building project, right? Which, you know, people are just like, oh, they're all living on, why do they live on reserves? Why don't they move? We were forced on reserves. So we were forced on reserves to make way for white settlers. And so it's a great question for me when we're talking about Unbroken, because this is a way that I can talk about, you know, why so many Indigenous women, why so many women and girls are Indigenous who've been murdered or missing on the Highway of Tears. When you're going down that highway, there's multiple Indigenous nations that come off of that highway. Some, you know, Nishka, I think it's 100 kilometers off. I think mine is 10 kilometers off the highway. That's from Prince George to Prince Rupert, the Highway of Tears. And, you know, people are like, oh, what's going on with that? We were forced on reserves in many ways. You know, we weren't allowed to leave. In many instances, we weren't allowed to leave the reserve without a visa, without the Indian agent approving that. And these reserves were on unfertile land. We couldn't grow food. At the same time, our subsistence economies, our trade economies were outlawed. Our culture was prohibited. We were basically forced in to be welfare recipients. Like, what else were you? This was encrusted in the law, right? That we're under today. So we still live under the Indian Act. We're one of the only countries in the world that abides by race-based legislation. So under Canadian law, I am actually legally defined as an Indian because I have Indian status, not a Canadian. I still have a Canadian passport, but I'm seen as an Indian. And so these laws, you know, that really came from this notion that we were subhuman and that Christianity was coming to save us and the colonials were coming to save us, placed us in these positions where we were forced into starvation, not just through residential school, but through the reserve system. You know, we talk about the children that suffered at residential school. We often don't talk about, imagine having your kids taken away and you have absolutely no choice by the RCMP. Generations, often I've spoken to survivors and they're like, I went, my mom went, my grandma went. And that's wild to think about. But think about the parents suffering on these reserves in the middle of nowhere, that is not our traditional territory. Our traditional territories are hundreds of thousands of kilometers. We often had summer camps. We had winter camps. We had like sophisticated governing structures that we still have. But imagine being placed into these positions where you have absolutely nothing and your community is forced into this disconnection. And then how do you cope? Right. Everyone's telling you, get over it. get like just assimilate and get with the program. I don't think free counseling for us came into being until around 2018, because I remember I would have to go to my counselor and make up this like completely outrageous story. I mean, not make it up, but tell them the worst parts of my history, you know, boil it down and cry. And then it'd be a white man on the other end saying, okay, we'll give you 4 sessions a year. Right. And so imagine just having no counseling, no support. Your entire community is an absolute crisis for generations. How are you going to cope? Right. How are you going to get through this when it's such a collective trauma? And you have, you know, it's like when we're thinking about the opioid crisis today, you know, why are people doing that? Well, we're in a state of crisis. Look at our world. And so, you know, I think that's something to think about. And it is amazing that now, like, there needs to be way more, but First Nations Health Authority, for example, has free counseling unlimited. I think that should be for everybody. I think we'd see less people in crises, but that's sort of, you know, where we were at and where we are at. Don't forget, we're still in a process of colonization today. It hasn't ended. The government is still fighting Indigenous people over our land and over our children and over our resources.
You know, there's a point in the book where you show the important distinction between the colonial and the Indigenous mindset. When you're describing your uncle, Neil J. Starrett, who countered Chief Justice Alan McEachern, who I'm sad to say his last name sounds almost like mine, in the original 1991 Gixon Wet'suwet'en land claim case, Delgamuukw et al. Versus the Queen. And you wrote the following. I thought this was such a beautiful and concise way that you illustrated it. He explained that in our Aboriginal law, the land, the plants, the animals, and the people all have spirit. A foreign sentiment to the colonials, who thought of the natural world as merely something to extract and profit from. Can you just speak a little bit more to this Indigenous worldview, as well as how this colonial worldview can be and has been so harmful, even in subtle ways?
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing I want to say is it's important to not homogenize. And I know you weren't coming from that place. You were more thinking of Gixan, but all Indigenous people have distinct cultures. I think there's 678 distinct Indigenous people in Canada with their own language, their own culture, with their own connections to the land. And I really got a taste of that when I lived in Yellowknife. And the Dene people were just so tremendously different than my Gixan people. It was a hard transition for me because of that. But I think for us as Gixan people, we see sovereignty in a very different way, I guess, than colonials from Europe do, in the sense that I think for them, when they were coming here, it was about control over, it was about power over, it was about having that in your hands. And for us, sovereignty is what binds us to spirit, to each other. And it's about connection and it's about responsibility. So when I'm talking about my grandfather, Walter Starrett, being groomed to be the hereditary chief of our house group, that is a massive role. You know, in modern times, it takes a lot of money. It takes a lot of work. And it's really about caring for not only the lands and, you know, the salmon and the animals and the forest, but it's also about ensuring that our lineages stay strong, ensuring that our cultures stay strong, and ensuring that our generations will be strong, taking care of the most precious beings of our societies. You know, we call our children majagali, which it means little flowers, or delicate little flowers. And that's how we cared for them, just like the elders. And everyone was cared for, everyone was loved, and we were thriving. And I think, you know, when we're thinking today just about the way that our way of thinking is so attuned to disconnection. I think we need to return to a sense of connection. And that's not to say, you know, Indigenous cultures, including mine, weren't perfect. You know, we definitely, I don't want to romanticize our people like that. But there was definitely a better way to care for the earth and to care for our communities in ways that built community cohesion and built strong people who had a strong desire to care for the land, because that's how they lived. They lived off the land. So that was, you know, it was like taking care of a community member.
Angela, one of the things you tell us, and these statistics, although I've heard them before, it's always shocking to read again. You tell us that Indigenous women are more likely to die prematurely or experience violence than any other race of women in Canada. While making up only 4% of the female population, Indigenous women and girls in Canada made up almost 25% of all female homicide victims in this country between 2001 and 2015. I want to ask you about the roots specifically of systemic anti-Indigenous female violence here in Canada. What are the roots of that? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, when I'm just kind of, it's a good segue to come from what I was just talking about, because for our Indigenous women, they're the backbone of our communities, right? They're the knowledge keepers. They're the ones who know the territories the best. And I think when the colonials came, they saw this immediately and knew that they had to strip Indigenous women of their power immediately. And so it's really interesting when you go to a lot of communities, I believe Squamish in particular, they called them captains. They said, we'll make every man a captain. And a lot of our cultures, you know, I think Gixxen people are really lucky in that we've kept a lot of our feast hall system really intact, and we've kept our roles and responsibilities really intact, and our matriarchs and our chiefs, our hereditary chiefs, all of those systems we've really kept intact. But a lot of the nations, I think, you know, they had a lot of women leaders, and the colonial said, no, these will all be male captains. As well as a lot of the oppressive laws at the beginning, you know, even when I'm talking about those visa systems, a lot of the justifications for that were to keep women at bay from settler men. And so a lot of the women had a lot of these oppressive rules, you know, doubled on them. They weren't allowed to stay in rooming houses, so they couldn't get jobs as house cleaners or go work in the canneries or visit relatives in the cities, all of these things. But I think ultimately it was ensuring a system of patriarchy. And I don't know if I get into this in my book, but, you know, I think one of the ways that the colonials succeeded is that in some regards, and there's a lot of research done on this, they got Indigenous men on board, right? And, you know, a lot of the original crafters of the Indian Act who were supporting it went from calling it an oppressive piece of legislation to a sacred right. And so you see Indigenous men on the take in this way. And I don't blame them. When you have zero power, you know, and you're offered a crumb, you're going to take it. But it was a really powerful way to instill patriarchy. And I think the way that toxic masculinity is rising right now, as much as divine femininity is trying to rise, I think it's being pushed down by this this desire to have a hold on the toxic masculinity. That's a byproduct of colonial violence, right? And it's I think things will shift, but it's going to become a lot more polarized before we see things kind of go back or attempting to go back to harmony again.
When we were in the green room before, you talked about how there's this tendency sometimes to kind of swim in the trauma stories. But what about the act of celebrating life, finding the joy? I'm just wondering what you're seeing happening in your own life and in the lives of Indigenous women that you know. How are they expressing themselves, celebrating life, as an act of healing and decolonization.
Yeah, it's such an exciting time to be Indigenous. You know, I'm just thinking about all of these fashion designers who are in New York right now showcasing their fashion. But for them, it's more than fashion. It is an expression of cultural power and sovereignty, the way that I just explained it. It is such a, it's not just about showcasing our culture either. It's about creating a new path forward, right? People are always asking, how can we listen better? And man, like when you're talking about Maxwell Johnson and his granddaughter, and that was such an amazing opportunity that they provided to BMO and the VPD to come to their big house and learn and see their system of law and see their system of justice. What happens in their big house, in their justice system, when someone breaks the law? It's very different. It's very much so calling people in to transform rather than punitive and forcing people into an inhumane prison. It was so powerful and so beautiful and such an incredible opportunity for people to see a different way. And I think, you know, we're learning about all this trauma, and I think that's very important. We need to learn about these systems of violence because they're still intact. And so when I'm speaking as a white person now, if we want to dismantle these systems so that we can be more connective human beings who are more in tune with beauty and love and joy and peace, then we need to think about how we're going to break apart these systems that are working actively to destroy that for all of us daily. And once we do that, or simultaneously, we can look at Indigenous cultures and not romanticize them and not appropriate them, but listen to the ways that they act as sophisticated governing bodies of law that could teach us so much about how to maybe change our justice system, our policing systems, our media systems. We have all of that in all of our Indigenous cultures. You know, we have witnesses. For me, that's kind of like the media. If somebody can't come, there's all these people witnessing who are going to tell you what happened there. And so there's just so many beautiful opportunities. And I just see Indigenous people thriving right now. Even my son, I'm just like, oh man, like, you know, I don't see his generation like getting hammered as 20-year-olds, like going to the, you know, getting drunk and jumping out their windows, you know, to go party, because they're not living in trauma. And he just has no interest in that. You know, I see even 20-year-olds, I know it's not everybody, but sometimes I'll go out and I'm like, oh yeah, they didn't live in trauma. So in the same way that we did, you know, in the 90s or the 80s. And so it's just a really exciting time. I think we're breaking generational curses. We're breaking cycles. And, you know, it's just a good time to be Indigenous, but it's also a good time to be human in some ways. Other ways, not so much.
Yeah. Just one more reminder to our live audience, in about 7 or 8 minutes, we'll get to some of your questions for Angela. So go ahead and keep typing those into the comments field there on YouTube. Angela, what is your message to Indigenous youth today? What is your hope for their future and the future of your son and his children?
Yeah, I think, you know, we were talking a little bit again, like in the off stage or whatever, the green room, about my love for people like Esther Hicks and people who are talking about rewiring your brain and changing your energy. And, you know, I was a street kid. Like I did everything on my own, and I really tapped into that from a young age. You know, my mom, I have this book, it's like from the 50s, and it's this man, and it's kind of old school. I haven't really looked into it that much, but it's all about the power of positive thinking. And I'm not like a toxic positivity person. I'm not about that. I'm about like healing and changing your energy. But I just want Indigenous people to know, like, you can be anything. There are so many barriers that we face, but You know, I had a spiritual guide tell me once, like, this is all an illusion. These people who you think are so oppressive to you are just like little pixies kicking at your shins, and it's all going to disappear. And I don't know if that was even true, but that's, I started to imagine that, and eventually it did. And I just started to focus on my dreams. Like, my God, like, I can literally, yesterday I was flying a plane. I can literally do absolutely anything you put your mind to. And I know it's hard. I know it's hard to rewire your brain. And honestly, I spent a whole year doing that last year. Like, that's all I did. And I want Indigenous youth to know, like, don't fall for the idea that you need to do something that your parents or even your ancestors or even your grandparents or elders want you to do. My stepdad wanted me to work in the bank and have a hot dog stand on the side. And I felt like I was constantly disappointing him by being an award-winning journalist, seriously, or being an artist or all of these things. But I took a very weird path. Somebody asked me the other day, you didn't belong all your life. Do you feel like you belong now? No, I love how weird I am. I love how I don't fit in. I don't like name brands. I don't like movie stars. I don't know much about movies. I don't know much about celebrities. I just like being my weird self. And I think people need to embrace that, that uniqueness, and just take your own path and do what you want, as weird as it may be. When I wrote Unbroken, this was super weird. Part memoir, part investigations into missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, like investigative journalism. Everyone was like, that's, I don't think you can do that. And I just did. I had one person that believed in me and I just did it. And this is a national bestselling book. I don't know how many copies we've sold, but it's over 10,000 now. It's gone through its second run. I went to Massey the other day and they said, this is our most popular book. Never would I have thought that as a youth ever, but I just followed my dreams and followed that, you know, not beaten path, unbeaten path. So I guess that would be my message to everyone, really.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Thank you. Before we get to the audience questions, there's one more thing I wanted to ask you about, which was a theme that runs through your book, which is about the importance of believing someone when they share their experience of harm done to them. I just want to ask, for those of us who may not have the knowledge or skills around supporting someone who might need to share these kinds of experiences, the safe person, what advice would you give? How do we take that information and how do we support someone and believe them when they're sharing a story like that?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I have a story that's too long to tell right now, but when I was in a group home, I had a group home, like the kind of dad of the house, I guess, believe me, but also believe in me at the same time. You know, I think Indigenous people, we weren't believed about residential school. Like, people would literally tell me that I was lying. They'd be like, that didn't happen. That's like, so you're making it up. When the TRC report came out in 2015, to have like hundreds of thousands of Indigenous people finally feel believed was so incredibly healing. It was like people could start their healing journey because they were believed, because they were seen, because people recognized what happened to them was atrocious. I think a lot of times, I think what we do as humans is we kind of try to downplay. We want to protect the person and protect ourselves. So we're like, oh, focus on the good things. Like, you know, I remember my mom died or my sister died and people were like, well, at least you had lots of support. And I don't think that's what people in pain need. People just want to be heard and not like poor little you, but like I'm here. What do you need? Tell me. I'm hearing you. I see you. I believe you. That is valid. That I always tell people that is so valid. I hear you. That is awful. And not jumping to like, let me do things for you, but just let me listen. And I think, you know, on my white side, I think I tend to be like, well, here's what I would do, or here's what I can do, or like, what do you need? And sometimes people just want to be heard and say, yeah, I see you. I believe you. I hear you. And it's just the most healing thing, I think, for a lot of people, especially in this society that we live in today, when people are often not believed, right? And making reports about horrific things that happen to them by police or by the public. It's just like our culture. And I think we need to change that. And that's like, a seems like a small thing, but it can be a huge thing.
Yeah. Thank you. We've got some nice questions and comments coming in here from the live audience. I'll share with you first a comment from Elaine, who says, "Wow, what synchronicity. Today I learned about the Japanese art of kintsugi, the art of putting broken pottery pieces back together with gold. Have you heard of that? They take broken pottery and they use gold to fill in the cracks. So it creates this new and beautiful piece."
Wow, I love that.
And Elaine says, "Angela, you are the gold."
Aww. I'm gonna have to think about that a lot later, because that's gonna like expand in my brain in a whole new way after this is over. Thank you so much for that, Elaine. That's so special. I love that.
Now we have a question from No Cause No Guns. I love people's YouTube names. Who says, "Do you know how the Warrior Woman song got associated with the missing, murdered Indigenous women and girls movement?" Miigwech, awesome interview.
Yeah, so the Woman's Warrior song was Martina Pierre. I believe she's in the Klepmuk. And that song came to her in ceremony. And in that ceremony, it was told that this is a song for all women. And so I actually asked her, I think it was her grandson or her son, if I could allow my son to sing that song. Because we do like keynotes and stuff, and we'd sing it together. And she said yes. But that's how it became associated with that. It was that song came from ceremony and it was gifted to all the women. And I think like as Indigenous women, like that's just front and center for us, right? When your people are dying, I think that's how that song became sort of associated so strongly with MMIWG, was because it was gifted to all the women. And that's such a strong issue for us in our communities.
Thanks. And thank you for the question. There's another one here from Tiara, who says, "What advice would you give to young Indigenous authors who are looking to break down the systems through our words?" Yakoke.
I think be you, and be whatever you want to be. I think there was a time when people like Lee Marical was like fighting just to get her book published internationally. And now there's just so many different kinds of books now. And I think every kind of book can, you know, break down systems of harm. I'm thinking about Cherie Demoline, or I'm thinking about Catherine Vermette's, her story, The Break, just created such awareness for me. But also just when you're talking about your words are beautiful, right? That's seeing Indigenous excellence. That is breaking down those systems of oppression. We are seen in many of these systems today as all of the stereotypes. And when we acknowledge, when we uphold, when we honor Indigenous excellence in whatever ways that is, we're breaking down those systems. And so, you know, I think it's so amazing to see so many different authors now, you know, bestsellers, New York Times bestsellers. I don't know if that's the same Tiara, but my friend Tiara Cash just published this incredible book. Yeah, your book is doing just that. Your book is showing kids to be proud of their skin, of their brown skin. And that's massive. My son wearing his ribbon shirt to school, like I could have died, because I had no pride. I was, you know, bullied and stuff as a kid. And I told everybody I was anything but Indigenous. And to have that pride, that's breaking down those systems when we're visible, when we're visible in doing incredible, amazing things. And that's what we need. And I'm so proud of you, Tiara. Like, I saw your stories today and I felt like, oh, like just so happy that it's just, you're touching so many different groups of people, you know, like it's just so powerful to watch. And Tiara is like amazing in terms of like the work she does. And there's a CBC story that you should watch that I did on her called Reclaiming. I'll find it, or maybe Tiara can find it and put it in the link. But she's brilliant, like just a, they're brilliant, an incredibly brilliant soul that everyone should follow and learn from. And I could just go on. You could do a whole thing about that.
Oh, that's great. I love that. I love that you two know each other and have that relationship. There's another nice comment here from Colvier who says, so beautiful to hear your words of inspiration for Indigenous women and girls. You are a real warrior, Angela. Wish you all the best.
Thank
and
you.
And Tiara says, crying. Yakoke, hoke. Thank you for continuing to inspire us all. You are so incredible. Uh-huh. There's a question here from Marla who says, can you tell us what you're doing next? And what are you reading now?
Oh, I like that question. So there's a couple of things that it's dependent on, but I think I'm writing my next book now. I'm also on tour. So this is like my second stop on the tour. I'm calling it my fall tour just because there's so many stops. Like I think I'm in Lethbridge soon. And then like, it's just, it's pretty.
You've got a busy schedule. I saw on your website.
Yeah, it's pretty heavy. And that's like leaving a lot of stuff out on the website. So yeah, I'm just speaking my truth in a different way now and being comfortable to give my opinions on stuff, which I wasn't allowed to do before. And walking a gentler path, just keeping my nervous system very even keeled. I mean, that's been a huge thing for me. Imagine going from your adrenaline is on 1000 every single minute of the day and you're like exploding mentally into soft, gentle, relaxed, calm. That's, even if I was just to continue doing that, I would be very, very, I'd feel very, very successful. But yeah, I'm writing my next book is going to be on men.
Oh.
Yeah, it's going to be a sequel. Wow. Seriously.
So, stories of Indigenous men.
Like I don't know if it's going to be a focus. I mean, I think I will interview a lot of Indigenous men, but I think it's going to be about men in general.
Oh, wow. Yeah,
like breaking cycles.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm excited for that.
Yeah, me too.
And what are you reading now is the second.
Oh, what am I reading now? Oh, so I did my Audible book and the guy from Audible gave me this book and it's this guy who's doing meditation stuff now. His last name's Ruben, Rick Ruben.
Does that sound familiar? the music producer. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, yeah, right, right.
Now he's into
a huge music producer. Now he's doing right.
He's doing, I think, transcendental meditation. I might have that wrong, but that's, I mean, I've opened one page, but I've just been so busy. That's what I'm going away this weekend. And that's what I'm going to crack open.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's a very Banyan-ish book.
Yeah. All of my books are. The other book that I finished recently was Becoming the One by the Vancouver author. Is it Shayla? Shailene?
Oh, I don't know this
one. Yeah. People want to like Google it. She's from Vancouver. She's incredible. Her Instagram has like millions or a million followers. And it's such an amazing book. And I got the audio book, I got the regular book, and then I also took her course. So wow. I guess I highly promote that book suggest that book.
Cool. Well, our fantastic podcast producer and events curator Jacob Steele's just put up Rick Rubin's book link and the Becoming the One link on the Banyan website. Yeah, and of course, in the chat, you'll find the link to Unbroken, which is the book to read, I would say, a fantastic book. And of course, we've been speaking with Angela Sterrett, the author of the book. And Angela, maybe a nice way to close, I'd like to ask you about actually the opening of the book, where you have, you list in memoriam the names of all the Indigenous women, girls who were murdered or went missing along the Highway of Tears and in Vancouver. It's a long list. It's an important list. I'm wondering if you could just talk a little bit about why you wanted to open the book with their names and how we can remember these people, remember these women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when I was first doing my reporting on, actually on that list, I mean, not first doing my reporting on the women and girls and Two-Spirit people, but when I was looking at the list, I wanted people to just see it, right? Have a visual of like, these are how many names, but also to see people as people who have a name, a nation, a story, a family, a community, and a country that loves them. And when I was researching this list, a lot of the media outlets had just gone by the RCMP's story rather than the family members. And a lot of the information was wrong, including some of the women's names. Like Lavina didn't go by Gloria Moody. She went by Lavina Moody. And that took a lot of primary research, like firsthand research, talking to family members. And yeah, I think it's just really important for people to understand that these women have more to them than just their deaths. They're more than just a number.
Thank you. There's one more audience question here I think we have time for. Have you ever thought about writing poetry or fiction? I've loved Louise Erdrich for many years.
What was the last part? Enjoyed?
Just a comment. I've loved Louise Erdrich for many years.
Okay. Yeah. So I have actually dozens of books of poetry that I've written. And considered publishing them. I was reading them for this book and I was like, wow, I was like too weird. Like no one's going to even get what I'm talking about weird. But yeah, I was a poet and I wrote songs for a while. There was like a hip hop band and a punk band that I wrote songs for. And actually this book, Unbroken, started out as fiction. But that became actually harder to write than nonfiction because I think you're including so many more details and getting into like each piece and slowing everything down. And it was just too traumatic for me to fictionalize my story. Fiction is hard. I honestly have no idea how people do that. It doesn't work with my brain. I even like all I consume is docs. That's why people are giving all these movie references and I don't know what they are. I watch docs, I listen to podcasts, like I don't, but I love poetry. I love poetry, but I don't like reading it. I just like writing it. So yeah, I like that question because I'm a big fan of writing poetry and reading fiction, but just, yeah.
Right. Very cool. Very cool. And thanks for that final question again from No Cause, No Guns. And a big thank you to everyone in our live audience for joining these live events. And of course, you can find all our episodes or the vast majority of them on our YouTube channel. And you can listen anywhere you listen to your podcast as well. Just look for Branches of Wisdom. Angela, it was really, really a pleasure to have you here today. And an honor to speak with you. And I'm really excited to hear about how this next chapter of your life goes now that you're done at CBC.
Thank you so much for having me. And thank you so much for all the questions. And Yeah, it's been so cool just knowing that Banyan Books was a place I went to as a teenager and still go to and could spend hours in there. And now I'm speaking with Banyan Books. So it's been a true honor and a pleasure. So thank you so much for having me, Amiya.
Thanks for joining us for Branches of Wisdom, a podcast of Banyan Books and Sound, Canada's spiritual and healing resource since 1970. Our podcast producer is Jacob Steele. The show is edited by Abdo Habani. Watch all our conversations on YouTube by searching for Banyan Books or listen on your favorite podcast platform. Please subscribe, follow, like, and leave your reviews and comments. We love to hear from you. For all our live events, books, and more, visit us at banyan.com.